When you think about making it, what comes to mind? Working to get ahead? Being able to afford the good life? Leaving a better world for your kids or the economy in general? Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of February 20th, 2015.
We're at a bloco or block party, really. There are people in costumes and makeup. I can see people wearing feathers, face paint. Woo! I just got sprayed with foam. Nice, thank you.
You heard me in Brazil just then, on the street at Carnival in Rio a few days ago, because over the last week and for the next few weeks, we're doing something special on the show. That question about making it, we're asking it on a global scale. It's in partnership with the BBC in a series called Six Routes to Riches. And here's what we want to know. When the global economy collides with real life, what happens? How do you make a better life? And what does that mean? We're going around the world to find out. Last week, you heard from Germany. This week, Nigeria. Next week, you'll hear my reporting from Brazil. I've spent the past 2 weeks there, talking to people at the top of the economic ladder, those working their way up, and everyone in between. And over the next few weeks, we'll also report from India, China, and the U.S. But back to Brazil for a moment. Just 5 years ago, the economy there was growing at more than 7% a year. Brazil was exporting iron ore, coffee, beef, and all the services supporting those commodities were booming. That meant that tens of millions of people were joining the middle class. It's now the largest economic group in the country. It includes people like Eleonora de Mello. She's 26 and works in an upscale teen boutique at a mall in Sao Paulo. She sells clothes on salary and commission. But now the economy, it's getting weaker. I had dinner with Eleonora and her family, and she told me she's worried that the downturn in Brazil's economy could hurt her dream to save enough money to open up a beauty salon.
I work in the oldest, most renowned, and most traditional mall in São Paulo, and the clients that we have are loyal clients, old clients, who have high standards. But now they are afraid to expand, to spend. They are not buying as before, and I am afraid too, because my money, my work, will represent my money, which through this money of my work, I'll be able to afford my future and hopefully my salon in the future.
You'll hear more from Eleonora and her family next week, including her mother's story about coming to São Paulo as a teenage mother and working her way up from a maid to a woman who owns her own home free and clear. You'll also hear about whether Brazil's middle class can hold on to the good life. A lot of people we talked to there were pretty worried. We're going to share their stories with you. We'll also explain how what happens in Brazil affects people in other parts of the world. Soon we'll go to India, China, and part of the U.S. But first, we're going to visit the biggest economy in Africa, Nigeria. And not just with any reporter, but someone who grew up there and has watched it change and shift. The BBC's Nkem Ifejika. And before we dive into Nkem's story about entrepreneurs in Nigeria, he's here to give us an overview of what makes the country's economy tick. Hi, Nkem. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
When we put this show together, we're looking at all these different countries. What does Nigeria tell us about the global economy? What's going on in the economic situation there?
I mean, Nigeria is definitely plugged in to the global economy for good or for ill. If you take, say, the price of oil, which has fallen a lot over the past year or so, Nigeria has been affected. Nigeria is Africa's largest exporter of oil. So, and something like 70 to 80% of government revenues comes from oil. So the fall in the price of oil has been very bad for the Nigerian economy. So that's just one aspect. That said, Nigeria is still growing. You know, Nigeria is still growing around 5, 6% a year. It's been doing so for the past 10 years or so. Growth has been revised down for 2015 because of shocks in oil prices and because of the devaluation of the Naira. But you know, people, there's still a lot of money in the country, and it's a huge population as well, 170 million people. It's about the seventh largest population in the world. So you have all these factors that just kind of tell you that, you know what, it's an important economy. People should pay attention to it.
Last week, we focused on Germany, and we get these little portraits of economic identity, sort of where economics and psychology collide. In Germany, there was a lot about debt and how it's the same word for guilt. I'm curious whether in Nigeria there's a lens through which citizens look at the economy that tells you something a little bit deeper about how they view their economic life.
There's a thing in Nigeria called, I guess young people these days call it a side hustle, which is a business you do on the side. Yeah, that's what it's called. It's a side hustle, or you can call it, one of my favorites is a 5 to 9. So, you know, you've got your 9 to 5, and then you go home and you do your 5 to 9. And that is what brings in the money, because the formal sector is just not big enough to cope with the number of people. So if you have, you know, millions of graduates going into the jobs market every year, and there are no jobs for them in the formal sector, they will have to find some way to feed themselves and their families. And that is the side hustle. You do a different job. You do something to make ends meet. And if you're lucky enough to have a salary, chances are your salary will not pay you that much. So what you do is you have something else that you do. And most people buy and sell. And Nigerians can always find a way to make something, turn something into a commodity.
You grew up in Nigeria. What's changed over the years? And how did you see it, you know, going back now, looking at it as a presenter?
What I've noticed is, and what has really struck me, is the sophistication these days of the businesses. So people are doing much more interesting businesses. So once upon a time, I'd say that Nigerians were well known for buying and selling. Trading, it's the simplest form of business. You buy something for a low price, you whack up something on it, and then you sell it for a bit more, you keep the profits. That is very simple, very basic. But people are becoming a lot more sophisticated and a lot more interesting in the way that they do things. You know, so people are doing things like media and telecommunications and services. Services are now a huge part of the Nigerian economy. Once upon a time, it was all about oil. But now there was a rebasing of the Nigerian economy last year. And it turns out that oil, which Nigeria is almost synonymous for, is only 14% of GDP.
Wow.
In terms of the grand scheme of things, it isn't that big a deal. So people are getting their money from all sorts of different places. That said, there are still the big issues. Infrastructure. Infrastructure is a huge, huge problem. So, you know, I used to joke when I was a kid that if an American car company wanted to make an advert about how durable their cars were, just send them onto Nigerian roads. Electricity is a huge problem. New York City produces 5 times more electricity than Nigeria. So can you imagine trying to survive as a business? Let's say you're in manufacturing in that kind of environment where you do not have any electricity. These are the sorts of problems which have persisted for years and years and years. And they almost seem quite intractable. As if to say, I'm not quite sure how these are going to get fixed. Hopefully they will get fixed at some point, but these are the things which have stayed the same while other things have changed.
That's the BBC's Nkem Ifejike. Thank you so much.
No. Thank you, Lizzie.
Nkem will be back in just a little bit with his special report on the Nigerian economy. You heard about side hustles in Nigeria? Whatever you want to call them, moonlighting, second jobs, side projects, having a side business in this economy is a fairly common thing. Sometimes it's because we have many passions. Sometimes it's to make ends meet. Kim Buckley works to support herself and her daughter in Los Angeles, and her side business turned into another side business. Kim works in transportation with the LA Unified School District. She also drives for the ride-sharing service Lyft.
Money started getting a little tight. In the last few years, I've been paying for everything. We had new cars, you know, expensive apartment, and I was doing everything by myself, taking care of her. And I said, well, I can drive a little after work. So I started driving for them after work. I made quite a bit. It helped me not to live check by check. I was able to start saving after I started working for them. I started with Uber because someone got in our cars and recruited us to drive for Uber. And we weren't really interested in driving for Uber at first, but we looked into the company. They were offering a lump sum of money if we sign up with them as well. And so after we looked into the company, we realized they were really the same. And so we decided to drive for both. And it helps out because when one is slow, then you turn on the other one and then you can start working on the other one instead of just having one app open. Days that I start working for my side business, I come in to LA Unified. I work from 7 to 4, and then when I get off from work, I just turn on my app. I work downtown, so I start working until I end up either in the valley where I live, or if, you know, a couple of hours I'm feeling a little tired, then I'll call it quits. Having a side business have helped me financially in many ways. It has helped me to be able to save money, helped me to be able to not stress from check to check and not worrying if I have enough for the rent or the car notes and things like that. Driving for Lyft and Uber hasn't been complicated at all as far as filing my taxes. It's like having your own business. You don't have to be at a certain place at a certain time. You work on your own time and you make as much money as you want. And if you don't want to work, you don't have to.
Turn to more from our special series with the BBC, Six Routes to Riches, an in-depth look at the challenges and opportunities people face as they make a living around the world. We're taking a tour of six countries at the heart of the changing global economy. Last week, Germany. We heard from folks there on how the economy is changing for them, like this business owner, Jan Miem.
Like my parents' attitude, okay, you go to school, you do well in school, then you go to college, then you acquire a job, and this is the company you stay with, and then you retire. I think those times are entirely over.
Keeping up with the transitioning economy, that's a theme we also find in our next stop, Nigeria. As we learned earlier in the show, Africa's largest economy is a place where the entrepreneurial spirit is a part of daily life. Now we're going to bring back the BBC's Nkem Ifejuka.
This is Onitsha Main Market. It's the biggest in West Africa, and some say the biggest in the world. 3 million people come here every day from across the region to buy everything from high-end mobile phones to low-tech plastic containers. On the surface, Nigeria may not seem like a country that can teach the world much about how to do business. Elections have been postponed because of the insurgency raging in the northeast. Corruption is still a huge problem. Government revenues depend on the oil and gas industry, which benefits the few. But Onitsha shows that the Nigerian economy is finding other lubricants. Every Nigerian is familiar with the concept of the side hustle, a business on the side. This is a country where everyone has a startup in their front room, including my mother. I'll never forget coming home from school one holiday to find the entire living room and dining area stacked floor to ceiling with cartons of sunflower oil for sale. And it was my grandmother who taught my mum that if you were lucky enough to have a salaried job, that was just pocket money. The real money came from your 5 to 9. Can Nigeria itself turn these side hustles into something more? And how do you succeed in a country under transition? What does success look like here? Here's what Mrs. Madam Nemuche said to me at the Main Market. She sells wigs from a stall.
You know, when someone is successful in Nigeria, how can you tell? Is it because of the car that they drive or the kind of house that they build or they go abroad? How can you tell that somebody has made it in Nigeria?
You see his investments, his factory, his the number of employees he has. Not cars. No, not cars.
Not cars, but investments in the greater good. Something bigger than the bottom line. It's all about making a difference. And it's a common refrain among Nigerians. Adam and his colleague Chibuzo Okpara created Integra Health. It's a business that aims to transform the way that Nigerian hospitals work.
It actually started when my dad was a professor in surgery, and he died at home while my brother, I, my mom, we're all in the health industry. It's just that family of doctors. And we were at home, and when he died, he had a pulmonary embolism. When he died, it was like in 10 minutes he was dead. But he had started complaining about his health like 2 hours before. And what I realized was that he didn't die because there was a lack of resources. He died because the resources weren't deployed well.
Like many in a new wave of Nigerian entrepreneurs, Adam and Chibuzo came home to build their startup after studying and working abroad.
When we came back from Poland and we founded Integra Health, we found ourselves dealing with a lot of clinics and hospitals that had the same problem. They couldn't tell which drugs were genuine, and in addition to that, they couldn't actually get the drug that they wanted on time. They'd have to call 6 or 7 suppliers and see, okay, do you have this drug, and what is the price, and then call the other person. So it was just a tedious process that, to me, had a solution.
This is what I'm curious about. Why come back from Holland? You know, it sounds like you could have had a good life.
Yeah,
I mean, you're in Europe. You know, you're in the working in the healthcare industry. They get paid very well. Why come back and suffer in Nigeria?
Because I think it's all about impact. Whatever we did in Europe, we would have been a footnote somewhere.
More than 60% of Nigeria's healthcare is private, so both the market and the challenges are huge.
One of the first places that we worked in, we found that there was poor use of drug medication. So when we came in, we told them, could you record all your drugs? And then we went through their backlog of orders and found out that 50% of the drugs they were ordering were basically the same thing.
So all those phone calls and all that hassle that Adam described that you have to go through to get hold of a certain drug in Nigeria, this hospital was doing twice as much as it needed to. How can this happen? Well, according to Adam, it's all down to the doctors.
Doctors are the healthcare system in terms of who owns the hospitals and who manages
and
the
who,
hospitals.
You get me?
And then most of these doctors do not have any management skills. They're doctors that have been good at what they do, and they get enough patient pool around them to open up a facility, and they keep expanding from there. There are no structures in place. There are no fail-safes. There's not a standard that he's running on that ensure a certain quality.
As Chibuzo's life experience has taught him, you need more than just expertise to save lives. You need a system. And one system they want to focus on is how the hospitals get their drugs.
So we have these open, I don't know if you know, we have these open drug markets.
I know you can buy anything in Nigeria. I've never heard of open drug markets, so I'm happy to learn.
It's an open drug market.
Miles
and miles of heaps of drugs, like a fish market.
This, it turns out, is how most hospitals buy their drugs. And Chibuzo and Adam want to close down places like these. The government agency, NAFDAC, has been working on it for years. But these guys want to implement a single online ordering system to completely remove the need for the marketplace.
It's a big challenge. Yeah. It's a big challenge to shut down a system that has been the status quo for so long. Yeah. And especially when you tell hospitals, no, I don't want you to order from these drug markets. And the hospitals go like, you want me to spend 3 days calling 18 suppliers and getting fragmented orders? So before you're able to solve that, you have to give hospitals a more reliable, simpler approach to actually order their drugs before saying, okay, do not deal with these people.
But these people do include genuine drug vendors as well as fake. So doesn't Integra Health risk upsetting a lot of people?
Certified legitimate distributors are happy. The ones that are not legitimate, that cannot get on this platform, are going to definitely lose business because of the fact that we're streamlining more orders through legitimate sources. And eventually, that is our strategy to single-handedly slow down the reliance on these open drug markets when it comes to our healthcare system.
Well, not single-handedly.
Single-handedly. With a bit of help.
There's a lot of hands in this place.
Integra Health has shown us how important the desire to make a difference can be in building a business. As part of Nigeria's growing services sector, there is no doubt about its potential to be transformative. But how many jobs could a company such as Integra create? And how many Integras could there be? Because in the end, it's all about creating jobs and making sure that people have enough money to spend, right? Zainab Usman is a Nigerian economist.
So first of all, for you to be able to be engaged with this sort of tech startup enterprise, you know, you need to have some sort of advanced knowledge of computing. And when you pair that along with the literacy rates in Nigeria, Nigeria has, for instance, 10 million out-of-school children, which is the highest in the world. You can see that these sorts of emerging sectors are not sectors that would cater to the mass majority of Nigerians.
Startups such as Integra may make a difference, but they are dependent on repats, people such as Adam and Chibuzo, with skills gained abroad that they brought back to Nigeria's big cities.
They're mostly concentrated in Lagos, which is really the heartbeat of Nigeria's economy. When you move away from Lagos and perhaps the capital, Abuja, there really isn't much else in terms of the distribution of these tech startups.
According to Zainab, we need to look beyond these firms to really turn things around. In search of the second big lesson in how to build a successful business, I headed out of Lagos. Innocent Chukwuma is a very successful businessman. He owns five different manufacturing companies around the southeast of the country.
This is
PVC plumbing.
PVC for plumbing.
Yeah.
Innocent is very optimistic about Nigeria's future. And looking out over his sprawling complex, it's easy to see why. The government recently gave him land to expand his business. In fact, I reckon he's the largest private sector employer in Enugu State. 4,300 people work at the plastics plant we visited.
In Africa today, anybody who can be able to invest well in Africa, in manufacturing, I tell you that in a short time, you make money as you want.
Innocent started small. He was a spare parts trader in his native Nnewi. He had graduated from turning his brother's spare parts side business to establishing his own import venture. As the prices of motorcycles coming in from Japan increased in the 1980s, he noticed something about the way they were shipped. They were coming in by barge in containers. And being a spare parts trader, he recognized that a motorcycle is made up of individual parts. And so he thought, if he imported the motorcycle in pieces, it would take up a lot less space in the shipping container. And he was right. At the time, importers could fit about 40 pre-assembled motorcycles in a single shipping container. But as individual parts, Innocent could fit more than 200 motorcycles in each container.
So you go from 36 units to 200 units.
220 units in one container.
Innocent now had a significant advantage over his competitors. He could sell his motorcycles for much cheaper.
Yes, because of this, my price is cheaper immediately by 40%.
Okay, but hold on a second, because if you bring them to the country, then you now have another problem because you have to assemble them here.
No, I don't have any problem.
Here's another advantage he had over his competitors. Labor in Nigeria is relatively cheap. A factory worker in Nigeria would earn about $500 a month, which is about $6,000 per annum.
So when I brought the first one, I called the local people, give them small training, they assemble it perfectly, and the price is cheaper.
Much cheaper.
When they're selling about $150,000 for one unit of motorcycle, I sold my own, $80,000.
Innocent's bikes were nearly half the price of his competitors. He sold three containers worth of motorcycles in about 3 months.
So I went back and bring about 10 containers. The 10 containers took me about 1 month to finish.
On the third trip, he ordered 20 containers. And once he had the process down, he was buying 200 containers.
Yes, yes. There's a time I bought about 200 containers in 1 month.
But Innocent's advantage didn't last forever. Soon, everyone was copying his strategy.
By then, the price clashed to 60,000. We brought it down to 60,000. But when I see that the price have come down and everybody's doing it, that is why I built this plastic plant.
Motorcycles were just the beginning for Innocent. He had another realization, that he could manufacture some of the motorcycle parts himself, specifically the plastic parts.
When I went to bring motorcycle again, I bring only the iron parts. I produce the plastic here.
Innocent now makes all kinds of products. His motorcycle business has expanded to cars and buses. His plastic plants now manufacture tables, chairs, water drums, plates, boxes for electricity meters, and much else. and he believes that anyone can follow his lead in Africa, which he refers to as a virgin place for entrepreneurs.
Africa here is a virgin place for business, mainly for manufacturing now.
You say this is virgin territory.
Yes.
But there are still lots of setbacks, you know? People.
There's a lot of setbacks, but every country has setbacks on their own before they will stand. But we have to start. We will start somewhere.
But starting a business in Nigeria is not easy. The day I visited Onitsha Market, a riot broke out. Traders were protesting against a new levy. The Trade Association decided to charge for a CCTV system, which the traders said the state governor had given them for free. It's the sort of surprise cost that wrecks a business plan. But corruption is not even the biggest problem here. The infrastructure presents challenges. Nigeria may be Africa's biggest oil exporter, but according to one estimate, it generates only enough electricity to power a single toaster for every 44 people. People make do with diesel-powered generators, which are costly. And that applies to big factories such as Innocent's.
Spend about 60 million on diesel every month.
That is a lot. So you're talking about 100 million naira
100 million
together.
Every month.
That's about $500,000.
Yes.
For Innocent, the high cost of energy is a necessary part of doing business in Nigeria. But it puts a real break in what entrepreneurs can achieve. Economist Zainab Usman again.
I really like being optimistic, and on the issue of energy, I don't think there is much optimism at present. Nigeria generates half of what North Korea currently generates. Sadly, it's something that people have grown accustomed to. So I am also Nigerian. I was born and raised in Nigeria. And for as long as I can remember, there have been power cuts. You know, but the thing is, the frequency has now increased. Sadly, it is not getting better. So whereas when I was much younger in the 90s, you know, the power cuts were just sometimes for like an hour or two or even up to 5 hours a day. But now electricity is sometimes only available for like 2-3 hours a day in some areas. In some areas, they go for weeks without power. So it's really not improving.
Zainab also points to a recent privatization of the national power company as offering hope for the future. But for now, it does take the shine off Nigeria as a place to do business.
Nigeria's doing business ranking is 170. It has increased a little bit from 175 last year. But it is still difficult. Only the very resilient, the very fierce, the very aggressive are able to survive in this environment.
But my final lesson from Nigeria is that the people I met are not put off by these obstacles. Most people will tell you that Nigeria is growing despite the government rather than because of it.
Thanks, Ankem. Before we let you go, we've been trying to turn a lot of this project over to the people on social media in every country that we're visiting. Can you describe some of the responses that we've gotten on social media in Nigeria and some of the questions?
I mean, for example, if you ask the question, what makes a successful Nigerian business? We posted this on the BBC House of Facebook page, and they said, well, helping others is the best measure of success. That was Sunusi M. Sunusi in Kano in the north. Alhaji Mele Yusufari, who's in Niobe, also in the northeast, one of the states with a state of emergency because of the insurgency in the northeast. Helping your subordinates grow. If you're someone who's been able to get some employment, chances are you're helping your brothers and sisters, you're helping your parents back in the village. So there is that multiplier effect of being able to create business and being able to create something from industry. And the real mark of success, the real mark of people who've done well, is who else you can help.
That's the BBC's Nkem Ifejike. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
That's all from Six Roots in Nigeria. Next week, we'll be in São Paulo, Brazil, meeting entrepreneurs catering to the new middle class. You can catch up on all of our reporting. Just visit the Marketplace website and click on the Six Roots link. And share your stories with us. How are you making it in the new global economy? A side business, maybe? Just use the hashtag #SixRoots. That's the number six and roots, R-O-U-T-E-S. This week on the show, we've heard stories of side businesses and workarounds, secrets of sorts that impact the economy or our personal finances. But what about the business of secrets? How much is a secret worth in dollars? We decided to find out from someone whose business is in unveiling government secrets. MuckRock is an organization that charges people, journalists, researchers, citizens, to file information requests. They use the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, to get data from the government. MuckRock files thousands of requests. Right now, they're suing the CIA. I spoke to Michael Morrissey about the process of uncovering information. He's a co-founder of MuckRock and a Knight Fellow at Stanford.
Ideally, we all want to be able to sort of peek in and be able to have effective oversight of our government. But the reality is that actually getting those documents costs the government money, and sometimes it costs the requesters time and money too. And so what happens is that there's fee structures that the government has set up, depending on if you're, like me, a reporter or sort of an average citizen, you pay one set of fees. But then if you're a commercial requester, you pay more fees for the government. Now, typically, the government says we're charging you by the page, so about 10, 25 cents a page, depending on what you're requesting and from whom. And then they charge the lowest paid salary for the employee who can help you get that information. Now, under the law, you're allowed to get anything from the government that isn't specifically exempt. And
what's exempt? Classified stuff?
So classified stuff, personal stuff, a lot of people wouldn't be happy with their tax or medical records getting out there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Anything that would sort of be an undue invasion of privacy is typically set as exempt. And certain trade secrets. So if Google is opening up some of their information to the government so that the government can make sure that they're not violating other people's privacies, a lot of times anything that's considered a trade secret is also exempt from disclosure.
So how do you guys make money?
So we charge a small fee to help people file a request, usually about $20 to file up to 4 requests, and that helps cover the cost of postage and sort of our processing time. One of the interesting things about the public records process is that most of the documents coming back are still actually in paper. A lot of people are sort of working today in a paperless office, and we've kind of starting to finally see that ideal. The government typically is decades behind, and a lot of agencies still the best way to communicate is with a fax machine.
Explain the economics of this. What are the impacts, do you think, of secrecy on my life or on, you know, the average taxpayer's life? Does it matter?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing we've found is that FOIA and transparency is like any other muscle, and that the more it's used, the better the government gets at it. And the more people are looking and watching at what the government does, the better behavior they're on. So one of the things we've done a lot is sort of looking at government contracts. And a lot of times what happens, for example, is say the government wants to put out an app that sort of lets you know, is it safe to go work outside based on the heat? Typically, and this is what we found in one case, they'll go out and they'll outsource that app production. But they don't really have very many people applying to bid on making that app. And so they'll hire one firm. That firm is just an outsourcing firm that'll hire another firm, which will sometimes hire a third firm that'll do something $20,000 worth of work where the government ends up paying $200,000 worth of work. And if nobody's looking at these contracts, that can be very lucrative for that first firm, but that's a pretty big waste of the taxpayers' dollars. And so when you have more people looking, when you have less secrecy, and when you have this information out there for sort of public inspection, everybody gets to pay less taxes and you get better quality services.
We've been looking around a little bit, and it seems like not just your operation, but there are some startups getting into this business in these sort of years of government secrecy. OpenGov is one outfit backed by some venture capital money. It almost feels like we're in a reactionary moment to the Edward Snowden revelations and warrantless wiretapping. Do you think there's an economic or a business opportunity here?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that part of it is ideological. I think a lot of people come in here and say, look, the government's stuck in the 70s and some cases the 60s in terms of sort of the way that they're storing and dealing with data. And a lot of people want to help the government get better. There's a lot of other people who see a very big economic opportunity here and sort of maybe helping privatize some of these traditionally government services. And they see that as a big business opportunity for themselves. Or just sort of consulting and helping the government figure out. There's a lot of money to be made in terms of sort of quote-unquote open government work. Now, some of these systems are not really that much better than the systems they're replacing when it comes to actual transparency, but I think anything's a big step forward when it comes to efficiency as long as you bring in sort of modern best practices.
What's next for you?
Right now, we're also looking at what else there is out there beyond what you can get through the public records process. On average, the public records that we've worked with have taken about 4 months from when you file the initial request to when you finally get a response. But one of the other things we're seeing is that just because a government agency is proactive and puts something online doesn't mean it's necessarily going to stay online. The most well-known case of this was data.gov, when a lot of these sort of online repositories that the government's taken a proactive stance and said, we're going to start publishing this information before people request it, a lot of those data sets will suddenly go missing. A lot of those data sets will get taken down if there's a federal government shutdown. And we want to go out and sort of figure out how can we help our users actually sift through that information and find the interesting bits to them.
Michael Morrissey is a co-founder of Muckrock. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
You can hear the story about how Muckrock sued the CIA. Just visit Marketplace's SoundCloud page. Last week, we asked you all to tell us your dirty little work secrets. What you keep to yourself, what you share, what kind of secrets sprout up in the typical office. Here's what we heard.
I guess private things, like I don't share too much of my personal life.
Personal stuff, like if I have a problem with some of my workers, you know, a lot of times I keep that to myself because eventually someone's going to open their mouth.
Not in trouble, just it might make things more complicated.
You know, I wouldn't want to go ask somebody about, hey man, are you dating? What's going on? Yeah. That's just impolite and then it's really, yeah, it's rude. So
I think I overshare.
Yeah, nobody needs to know everything about you. Gotta have something for yourself, I guess.
That's why I really don't say anything, because it's happened to other workers that I know, and I've learned to keep my mouth shut.
It happens a lot, and it brings you back to high school of, like, wanting to belong but then feeling really bad.
There are lots of secrets in our workplaces related to our salaries, stress, even relationships. And maybe there are some things we should try harder to keep quiet. I mean, who hasn't taken part in some kind of office gossip? Paul Bard is an organizational psychologist at the Fordham Graduate School of Business. He joined me to talk about the secrets we keep or don't. So why do we gossip anyway?
They have a level of anxiety. Sometimes that's exacerbated by, you know, rumors that there's going to be another layoff and so on. And that insecurity has people turning to colleagues to try to get reassurance that they're going to be okay. So they start talking about things such as management doesn't know what it's doing. By saying something like that, they kind of make themselves feel a little bit better that it's not them, it's management. But the problem is when you start talking about that, you're creating, it's called triangulation. It sounds like strangulation, and that's a very good metaphor for it, because it does kill relationships. When you go to another person with your complaints about, say, the president of your company, you kind of get trying to get reassurance that it's not me, is it? It's him, isn't it? The problem with that is, of course, you're creating a conflict for the person who's listening to you. In effect, you're taking your anxiety to a colleague and dumping it on her desk. The problem is, this person that you confided in about your complaints, you can't be sure that they're not going to go to your boss and say, hey, you better watch out for Lizzie.
Yeah, but we've all done it. I mean, haven't you?
If I think way back when I was naive and a new employee, I might have done such a thing. And sometimes it's done around the water cooler. And so you go along to get along. Yeah, that they really don't know what they're doing here. And I'm just trying to be one of the guys, get accepted, you see. But that doesn't contribute to building a team. So you can distinguish yourself in a positive way by not going along with things like that. You don't have to lecture them and scold them, but you can just not participate.
So how do you, as an individual, kind of make politics at work less toxic?
you can take the initiative, and when people start to badmouth, you can choose to not be defined by your acceptance by those other people. You can choose to say, hey, what would I want my employee, if I was my boss, what would I want me to be saying? And, of course, bosses want to be able to count on you. If I have a problem with my boss, I'll talk to my boss about that, not to one of my colleagues.
One secret that gets kept a lot in companies, and this is changing a little bit nowadays, is money, right? How much everybody makes.
Yes.
Do you think we should be more transparent about our salaries?
No.
No? No. Why not?
No. It's because that's an agreement that two people reach. I, the applicant or the employee, and somebody from management that's going to make that decision. And that's a personal thing. Unless you, of course, work for a union where everything is, or a government where everything is dictated by what level, job, title you have. But when you seek that information out, what's going to happen? Either I'm going to find out from you, my colleague, that you're making more than me. Well, that doesn't make me very happy. Or I'm finding out that you're making less than me, and that feels awkward. I don't want you to feel bad. So a lot of firms kind of have an implicit policy of just not discussing their compensation.
But wait a minute, though. What if the idea that sunlight is a great remedy? I mean, if you are, say, a woman and you find out that you are making less than a man who's got the exact same qualifications and you, the idea of the transparency there could really help you be on equal footing, that seems like a good thing.
Well, it's certainly helpful if you get your facts straight. There are places like salary.com, I think, is one of the websites where you can get some objective data. But, of course, it gets complicated in these arrangements when people get hired. There's a whole lot of variables that go into that. Now, obviously, if there is a pattern, objectively measured pattern of underpaying women, that's frightfully horrific. And, of course, we know there have been cases where it's taken intervention by the courts, the attorney general, to put a stop to that. So in there, there's a purpose for gathering information. But when it's casual in the hallway kind of stuff, it's filled with problems. Kind of like a lose-lose. There's no upside, except for the point that you make, which is very legitimate. If there is something going on that's inappropriate or illegal.
Thinking about all of this stuff, here's kind of where my brain is going. Why can't we just talk to one another directly, like people with some guts?
Yes, that would be emotional maturation. That's a good thing. So if you think back to adolescence, many people go through adolescence trying so very hard to be accepted, to be part of the in crowd. And then as we mature, we're going, gee, it's not worth that. I want to stand for something. And it's not up for negotiation just because I want to have a friend.
Or a friend at work.
Or a work friend, yeah.
Paul Bard is an organizational psychologist. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Great to be with you.
On next week's show, we're talking about economic classes and how we get where we are. So where do you fall? Have you spent your whole life in the middle class? Or maybe you climbed into a new financial class or did some backsliding? We want to hear your stories. Write to us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go, or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We just heard from a psychologist on spilling your secrets in a professional setting. But what do you do when you get off work? Matthew Schmuck has been bartending for 7 years. We asked him why he thinks people tell him their secrets.
Maybe I just seem like a wise sage to everyone else. It's really interesting, the things that people will share with you behind the bar. It's kind of freeing to share things with a stranger. There are no consequences if you tell me a secret. Love life is people's love lives are a big topic of conversation, especially now with Tinder and online dating and stuff like that. People come in on dates or after bad dates or before their dates, and they are just very open about their experiences, you know, whether they're good or bad. I really enjoy the times when they're oversharing or things, the dates are just really crashing and burning, because it's just it's just terribly entertaining to watch. I know that sounds terrible, but I guess it's like free drama, free ABC drama for you. I hear a lot about exes, I would say. So it's really funny and sort of awkward when they bring in their exes and introduce them to you, and they look at you with those eyes like, I know you know all this dirt, but don't you say a word, all right? It's like an unspoken secret bond. Because it's, you know, a neighborhood bar, so if you consider it your neighborhood bar, you know, you might bring a date to your neighborhood bar, or in some cases, all of your dates to your neighborhood bar. So you get to see the progression of a single person's dating, and you almost feel like, you know, like a family member, and you can say, oh, I really, whatever happened to Candace? You know, I really liked her. I think it feels safe to talk to somebody who maybe doesn't know everything about you to share a secret with them, because there's no real judgment or no opinion, and there's no consequence to saying it. I think the most recent one I had was someone I didn't even know had kids. He was such like a jovial guy, and then all of a sudden he, you know, had a couple drinks one night and confessed that he was going to lose custody of his children, and you're just like, you don't know what to say. You just, you know, want to console and, you know, offer an ear and a shoulder. But, and I don't necessarily think that he said it because he needed anything like that. I just think he'd had a hard day and just wanted to say it out loud. And I like that. I like that aspect of the job, because it's, you know, even if I can't offer any of the best advice or any advice at all, I think it's nice just to look somebody in the eye, you know, and say, it's okay. You're going to be okay.
That was Matthew Schmuck outside the bar where he works in Los Angeles. And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. On next week's show, we're talking about economic classes and how we get where we are. Plus, we're taking you to Brazil. Thanks for listening. This is APM.